I'm Queen Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulet.
This is Adam of Ethereal and E. Tune in on March 28th at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic on KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, and this is the final installment of KBOO's 2022 International Women's Month series. You can catch the previous episodes in this series on our website at kboo.fm/IWD. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne, and tonight we are celebrating Women's Month by listening back to two different selections of women-centered programming from the KBOO archive. This first piece, From Turban to Hijab, produced in 2008, is a montage of three Oregon women sharing their experiences wearing traditional head covering. They'll discuss why they wear them and what role it plays in their spirituality.
Am a Portlander who is age 35 years old. I am a Kundalini yogi, is taught by Yogi Bhajan. And I'm also an American Sikh, an Amrit Dari Sikh. I've taken baptism and vows in this particular lineage and faith. I'm currently studying a Sikh ministerial program with people all over the country and in Canada also. And I am a healer that is focusing at this time in massage. And I also am a East Indian classical dancer, do Bharatanatyam performance, and take classes in that.
My name's Shariah, I'm 16 and I'm a junior in high school. I love to rock climb and I run. I'm doing track and field this year. I'm trying to do the 400 meter, but I might have to practice a little more for that.
My name is Hukum Kaur Khalsa, and I am a Sikh. I'm 25 years old, and I've been a part of this Dharma, this path, way of life, for 3 years now. And it started through the practice of Kundalini Yoga. That is also the reason I first ever covered my head. I think it was a beanie, some kind of bandana, do-rag. Headdress, turban, it's also known as the crown of the disciple. It's a spiritual and royal symbol. And eventually, as I kept my discipline and my practice, it turned into one piece of fabric, and then it came into three pieces of fabric. The technology got more subtle, more complicated. The lines are a lot smoother now. And the turban, for those who can't see, it comes up to the third eye, up to the like a triangle point on the front of my forehead, and that serves to draw the energy up to the third eye and point of intuition, which is why it's relevant in Kundalini yoga or an energetic yoga of awareness. And as a Sikh, it also is my identity as part of that brotherhood of Sikhism. It creates us a unity in a sense. And it's very much become a part of my head and everyday life. So yeah, it was definitely an evolution. And the turban throughout my life has changed as I have changed. And I can kind of see through old pictures, oh, that's when I first came into the Dharma, and you know, seeing it change and getting better and seeing my own self more comfortable in it and becoming Hukam, my name, more and more. Because that is not my birth name, is a given spiritual name, which I'm growing into and understanding day by day and integrating. I love my birth name as well, and that's spiritual also. The name is very special to receive when you're on a path, is a name of that path. It's almost like another article of clothing, like a turban is.
At the time I first donned the hijab, that's what it's called, the hijab, it held a more rebellious meaning. It was right after 9/11, and because I'm white, I kind of tend to blend in with the crowd, and I didn't stick out as a Muslim. So I wanted everyone to know that I was a Muslim, I was proud of my religion, and if anyone had any questions to ask regarding my religion, I was free to answer them. And my mom didn't wear it at that time. I was about 10, and I did it purely out of that reason at the time. Initially, she didn't give me too much support. She was a little afraid of how everyone would react around me, and so was my family. But afterwards, they saw that it was something important to me, and my mom even began to wear it as well. With all the stereotypes that have come about since 9/11, I think I've had to take an extra strong view on my lifestyle and my religion and on my views of Islam. And so that basically was the catalyst to my own spiritual journey. I wanted to find out more about my religion. I knew that the violence and the terrorism was not part of my religion. I've grown up as a Muslim. I've never ever encountered any violent ideals in our religion at all. So I found that extremely absurd. But on the other hand, I wanted to see where people were getting these views. So I researched the Quran more, and I found it myself to be very peaceful, and I could reconcile it with the lifestyle I was living. It was just a matter of contextual understanding and being able to realize what the verse is saying and where people are getting these views, and then having a backup response that people may be a little bit ignorant of the verse, or they may just be misinformed. In any case, it's important that I should be able to explain that, because I am a Muslim and I should have answers for people if they want to know about Islam. The word salam, which is what I say to other people when I greet them, is the root word for Islam, which is Islam, salam. It also means submission to the will of God. And when we submit ourselves to God, we are bringing about peace, because God, He commands us to be peaceful. He commands us to act justly, and the only time violence is ever allowed is in self-defense, and even that's a last resort. And the better action would be to reconcile our differences through verbal communication. As a beacon of Islam, it is a beacon of peace, a beacon of tranquility, a beacon of communication for other people, and a door and an outlet to interreligious discussion, communication, and dialogue. जगदूत पति अदके तो आह ब्रह्मा दे त्रेषा गुरु इतवा है गुरु
So I first started growing my hair 9 years ago for this purpose, and I learned from my yoga teacher, who's also a Sikh, how to wrap the hair up on the seventh chakra. It's called a Rishi knot. And my yoga teacher, walked me through step by step on how to bring the hair up in that spot and how to tie a turban. Well, honestly, it was a huge transformation for me, and it was not necessarily an easy step. I really enjoyed brushing my hair and braiding my hair and putting it in buns and things of that nature. I've always really enjoyed that specific process and oiling my scalp. So that particular part was something that brought soothing and brought calmness to my routine. I love natural skincare also, so it just really blended in. When it came time to actually wear a turban all the time, that's when some discomfort around really being committed to this path came into being, because no longer could I put a turban on for an event and take it off and have my hair down. But it was really, it was a feeling of sometimes discomfort and stepping into something that is a powerful symbol that's so different than what most people in this culture do by wearing their hair down. So it was difficult, but I just really trusted in the teachings, and I trusted that it was a process that I would become comfortable with. And really what has happened with this process is it's brought me a deeper state of gracefulness. I feel more graceful, I feel more feminine, and I really feel more in touch with my maturity as a woman by wrapping my hair and by not necessarily needing to have the latest haircut.
Personally, it was a pretty easy transition, and I loved it. I had an easy time breaking out of molds, so it wasn't difficult for me, and I don't notice people noticing me anymore because it's so normal to me. In fact, it sparks great conversations with people on a spiritual side. And in terms of Sikhism, that was definitely an evolution as I became a better Sikh, so to speak. It really, like I said, is a crown, the disciple. It's like a symbol of royalty. It's like how you hold your head up high. It's a decoration of your head and holding yourself. And it's a subtle energy. It draws the hair up to the top of the head and covers it and protects it from the elements. And we're working with energy and drawing the energy up the spine, which is the point in Kundalini Yoga. And in Sikhism, it creates, as I said before, a brotherhood, whereas no matter your social economic status, you are royalty in the eyes of God, depending upon your heart and your compassion, your openness, your closeness to your own God. And it's like a crown. It's royalty. Before, only emperors wore turbans and rode horses. I have a bicycle, but I consider it my horse. And the turban I consider my crown, because I've stepped into a certain power as a woman. Oh yes, there's definitely a lot of sharing of technique involved. A lot of videos online of how to tie turbans. White has all colors in it, so that is the most popular preferred color, like a cream or a white. It's very radiant and extends your aura. I like wearing colors as well, like purples and red. I just have to match the suit with it. And for decoration, there's this circular piece of thin iron. It looks like the rings on Saturn. And I like to put that over the turban to give iron the sense of power to myself. I don't wear that too much yet. But again, it's a whole level of self-initiation, self-decoration. We'll see where I go with it. But I have ideas of feathers and jewels. There's also jewels that women wear right above the third eye on pins with an Adi Shakti, which is the symbol of feminine energy. It's a double-edged sword around a jewel. And the jewel is very personal. For example, I like blue stones, like maybe turquoise even, or lapis.
The cloth that's put on the head varies between about 15 and 25 yards. And they also actually, shape-wise, can be rather fashioned. There's a lot of fashion around what is the current shape that is popular. Back in the 70s, when the women in America started wearing turbans, they wore these very tall, like stovetop pipe-looking turbans that I have no idea how many yards of cloth are in. Currently, on a day-to-day, it's about a 15-yard, but for a dress-up occasion, I will add more fabric and make the top of the turban a little thicker. And then, in those cases, there's a silk part that I put on the outside. The turban is cotton, and on a dress-up occasion, I will put a stretch silk over the top, and then I will wear up on the turban a pin with a jewel that is a representation of the goddess, which is, it's called Adi Shakti or Akanda, and it's a representation of the primal goddess.
In Islam, we're encouraged to be modest, and there's also no compulsion in our religion, so it should be an independent choice to pursue wearing the hijab, and I don't think it's something that should be forced. However, it is a something that's valued in our religion to be that modest and to reach that stage of modesty, and it's mentioned in the Quran that all women and men should be modest in their interactions and in their clothing.
The only way we're gonna make a difference is if we all stand up and do our part.
Fortunately, there are quite a few Muslims in my school that wear it. I do know that in other schools, other high schools especially, there may not be such a large population of female Muslims wearing the scarf. It takes a lot of courage, in my opinion, and I'm happy that other people are doing it in my school. But if I were alone, I would still wear it and still strive to wear it every day. In terms of decoration, for different occasions, I do wear different hijabs. If I'm going somewhere that's fancy, I'd wear one that's maybe a little more flashy, more nice, more for the occasion. And definitely from different cultures, you can see the wide range of headscarves that people are wearing. Even when I'm doing sports, I have to look around for sports hijabs that are safe and fulfill the requirements of safety for the sport I'm doing, such as track or rock climbing. I can't just wear normal hijabs which require pins. I'd have to wear something that would close with a Velcro strap or some sort of tube-shaped hijab that I can slip on. If the hijab does come up in a conversation, it might be regarding the sports and how I'm going to be able to find a scarf that I can wear to the activities that I'm doing, such as rock climbing or any other sport. And sometimes I'll go on a rant like, oh my goodness, there's not enough outlets for these sporty Muslimas, these sporty female women, and we'll have our little discussions, and even with non-Muslims, we can get into some pretty long discussions on that. I was initially just wearing a normal hijab at first and trying to wrap it and make this art out of it where you have to wrap it perfectly and balance it on your head. And I was like, this isn't going to work for the very sporty Muslim. So I looked online and found maybe one or two websites. I was sad that there was only two, but happy that there was any at all. So I just ordered one sports hijab last week, and I'm waiting for it to arrive. I'm really excited for that, actually. In my house, that's my comfort zone. I don't wear it. Sometimes I do. I wear it when I'm praying and when I'm with other people in my household that are visiting, I do wear it.
Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Jiyo, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru.
Well, I wear the turban out in public and at home because in my home, I have the Sikh spiritual scriptures, which are called the Sri Guru Granth Sahib. And out of respect for that particular scripture in my home, I also wear my turban. But at night, I brush my hair 108 strokes and I braid it in one braid down the back, and that helps to calm the nervous system. So I bring it down at night when I sleep. It takes me approximately 5 minutes to put on a turban like this. I do beforehand get together with another person to fold the fabric, and then we take it, we pull it. It's like a long piece of fabric. We pull it, and then we fold it, and then I roll it. And so I actually have a drawer that's filled with the rolled up, it's like a paper towel roll. And so if I were to have to roll one all the time, it would probably be at least 10 minutes to put it on, but I prep turbans beforehand. My friend Hukum Kaur is the person that I currently roll turbans with, and we take turns, and I roll mine and she rolls hers. And we try to make it a joyous occasion by putting some nice music on, because it can be a little intense. But the path that we're on, the path of Sikhism, is a householder's path. And it's really designed to work with different metaphysical and mystical principles, but to ground them into family life and to physical existence. So whenever I'm tying turbans with Hukum, I really get the feeling like this act is something that helps to ground our practice into our practical life. It's something that's hard to do by yourself. So it's creating that family connection by having these tasks that require another person's help.
Currently, the turban I have now is about 5 minutes to wrap. It depends on the width of the fabric that I want to use that day, you know, how much energy I want to put into it. But I try to put a lot of energy into it every day because it represents a level of consciousness, a neatness, the way your room reflects your mind, the way my turban reflects my mind, how I dress. Yeah, it's an interplay of having the turban help me hold the vibration and holding the vibration by wearing the turban. It's like it's a technology. It helps me along this path.
Guru ki peri pai
God, you survived in
as a woman in America, as a Sikh woman, a lot of us wear turbans. And in India, women are starting to wear the turban more often as well, though it's more popular to wear a scarf over the head. But it's women are starting to step up into their own power and their own Shakti, which is the feminine, energetic, primal power. And so women are starting in India even to recognize their own equality and power and wear the turban as a symbol of that. There's one male turban called the Damala, which I have heard is an extremely long piece of fabric that wraps around, and it's beautiful. And I could tie a Damala. It's not just for men. And it's my goal when I go to India in a week to learn how to tie a Damala.
As a teenager, people are expected to conform to the fashion and pop culture and the certain trends, and even I, to some extent, aside from my hijab, do wear, at times, normal clothing and jeans and whatnot. Different Muslims wear different types of clothing, so for them it may be a different struggle, but a lot of us, I do know, have the courage and bravery to wear it. I respect other females that wear it, and just anyone in general who's might be going against the grain of pop culture and fashion trends. When I cover my body and wear this scarf, I'm asserting my identity as a modest person, and that also goes into my sphere of action, how I act around people, how I interact with other people, and I think it's a way that people will judge me for what I think and how I act rather than what I look like.
You gotta stand for something. You gotta stand for something. Reason.
I've never yet had to defend myself. However, if I were in that situation, I would stand up for others as well who wear head coverings of any path and faith.
You gotta stand for something. You gotta stand for something. Reason.
And this path has been extremely elevating. It's not always easy. It has its challenges. But to have the ability to do something that is not necessarily the norm in this country has really helped me to connect with people who are immigrants and who are from other countries. So I'm really grateful for that. It's really opened up my heart. Adike to aha Brahma de Dresha Guru
Eto ahe Guru. Women having an equal dress of the men, women being warriors as well as men being warriors. There's a lot of defense of India in the Sikh history, and there's a lot of women who led soldiers into battle for the protection of Hindus and India. So I really love the image of a woman in a turban on a horse protecting alongside her male counterpart. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, and if you are just joining us, you are listening to the final episode of KBOO's International Women's Month series for 2022. You just heard From Turban to Hijab, a montage of Oregon women sharing their experiences with wearing traditional headwear, produced for KBOO in 2008. Up next, we'll hear an International Women's Day special from 2017, produced by Emma Lugo on Transpositive. Transpositive is a current program on the KBOO air schedule, every first, second, and third Tuesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. This archival episode features a discussion on the intersections of gender identity and feminism.
Happy Women's Day. We are here today celebrating women and women's lives. And here today, we are also celebrating trans women's lives because trans women are also part of celebrating women's lives. And so today we're going to be having a conversation with Carol and with Jean. And then in a little while, we'll also be joined by Andrea, who was on our show last night. And we're going to be talking about trans feminism. We're also going to be talking about trans-exclusive radical feminism and just, you know, the whole issue of how can we as trans women support the broader women's movement? How can women support trans women specifically? And if there's ever any spaces where there's uncomfortableness between the trans women's community and other women, for instance, radical feminists, we want to like open up some space here today for that conversation. And I'm here today because I wanted to have this conversation. The conversation kind of started when Chelsea Manning was in the news. Chelsea Manning, who is in prison still in Kansas until May for WikiLeaks, for releasing wiki documents about the war in Afghanistan, and has served 8 years in federal prison, and at the beginning of her sentence changed her gender identity to Chelsea and came out in prison. And so we were having this conversation on this Facebook page, and a lot of the people on the Facebook page, there were a lot of trans women. There were a lot of people who were calling Chelsea a man, which is really offensive for trans women to call a trans woman a man. And also saying things that, for me personally, were so hateful towards trans women in this discussion about Chelsea Manning that I had to leave the page because I just couldn't have that conversation. But I know that there's space in the community where people have differences and where there is, you know, and but there's also room. I'm Jewish, and I know that like within my tradition, within my cultural tradition, there's room for conversation and for disagreement. And so Carol and I, who are both members of Jewish Voice for Peace, were able to continue this conversation about these issues and how can we find alliance and how can we be supportive. And, you know, I definitely consider Carol to be someone who supports trans women, but also who has some connections within the radical feminist community, which doesn't always support trans women. So, you know, I think that it's good to have those people in between so that we can navigate spaces that are culturally sensitive and how we can be able to listen to each other and figure out how to support each other. So, Jean, what's your story?
Well, my story is pretty simple, honestly. I am a trans woman.
I'm an older trans woman. I will absolutely cop to the fact that my opinions were and my sense was formed a couple of decades ago, and I tend to be somewhat steeped in a binary, you know, point of view. So I'll just admit to that up front. But the reason that I'm here today and I wanted to participate in this conversation is I am a self-avowed communist.
Communist.
Most of my stuff I do under the hashtag solidarity. I believe that solidarity does not equate to erasure, and that times have changed. We are faced with a new challenge, and the identity politics of the past several decades do not serve us well. We have to find commonality. We have to build solid coalition, or we are toast. Yes. And so we have to find these commonalities. We have to rise all boats. We have to find a sisterhood here that can work for us all. And that's why I'm here.
Great. Well, thank you. Did we have a call? Great. Okay, let's go to our first caller. Hi.
Yeah. My name is Andrea Haverkamp. I'm a PhD student at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon, where I study the confluence of various identities within the queer studies department and within the engineering department. I study the way in which these identities clash, collide, sever, form together. And I also study structural systems of oppression frameworks within feminist theory and queer theory. I guess I have been deeply involved within activist communities, environmental activist communities, labor union communities, and also trans and queer communities for about since I was able to. So.
Great. So let's go to our first. I have a question that I'd like everybody to discuss if they feel comfortable. So my first question is, how can the trans women's community support women's liberation generally? And the flip side of that is, how can women support trans women?
You know, if I may, I'm going to launch into a little bit of a metaphoric imagery here. When I think about what we're faced with right now, you know, is building coalition to address more immediate needs. We keep tripping over trying to solve the big picture when we have more tactical priorities right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I keep envisioning the Yalta Conference. You know, Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin sitting together. You know, despite all of the differences that that represented, okay? Mm-hmm. But they came together and they held together a coalition and an allyship to meet some immediate needs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the level that we have to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. We have to stop thinking about our distinctions and start thinking about our commonalities and setting some of these things aside. Not permanently, but at least to the level that allows us to recognize that we need to band together or we're going to lose. It's that simple.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's part of why, like, when Carol and I marched together in the Women's March, I mean, we marched for the women of occupied Palestine, which was, you know, something that we're both really concerned about. But there were lots of trans women there. I mean, yeah, I know you were there that day too, Jean. Andrea, were you involved in the Women's March?
I was an hour and a half south, so we had some activities in Corvallis that we participated in.
Yeah. So, Andrea, how do you think we can kind of bridge the gaps between our communities? What can we do to move forward and be kind of more supportive?
I guess building on the Stonewall movement and building on a lot of the Black liberatory movement, it's focusing on who is being hurt the most in our communities right now and deeply listening. Now, I've never heard a trans woman say, we want to erase women, we're trying to erase women, we're fighting against women. So listen to the words coming out of trans women's mouth, and then also treating hostile and you know, making sure it's not a room filled with hate and that we're listening to some of the most vulnerable people. 9 trans women one of which is actually a Two-Spirit Indigenous woman, have been killed so far this year in hate crimes. So I think first is all of us together as feminists who want a society where hate crimes don't exist to find solidarity and love and compassion for those who are experiencing tremendous levels of violence and put an end to that and then work our way up. Because when we work from our most vulnerable populations up, those in prison, those in sex work and sex trafficking especially, we help all women.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Thank you for sharing that. So we've only got about 5 minutes left in this conversation, but I really hope that, you know, as you listen to the Women's Day programming today, that you will consider this particular part of the whole conversation. It's only a small part of women's liberation generally, but for trans women, it's really important. I mean, trans women, we feel, I'm just speaking for myself, so, but I would say that as a trans woman, I feel like everything that I've had to do in my life in order to just prove that I'm a woman has been like, you know, an act in opposition to every message that I get from my culture. I mean, from the time that I was born, I was told that I'm not who I feel I am. And I mean, I feel very blessed and very lucky to live in Oregon because I live in a state where my gender identity is recognized and where I feel safe. But of course, I also have white privilege. So, you know, there's plenty. We, like Andrea was just saying, we had a vigil last night for trans women of color who have been murdered just in the last 3 months. So, you know, but still, it's a struggle. It's a struggle for trans women just to be able to get to the point where we're acknowledged and respected as women. And, you know, honestly, our culture isn't even there yet. I mean, we have some legal rights.
That's right. The culture is not there. Mm-hmm. And the overarching issue that there isn't a feminist, any femme identifying individual, doesn't matter, or even masculine identifying individuals who it's misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
The misogyny is so thoroughly ingrained in our culture. That is the commonality. That's the overarching issue that we all face. We all have to link arms against this and deal with it. It doesn't matter, you know, what other identities we have underneath that umbrella.
Right, yeah. And Carol, so from your perspective as someone who's supportive of trans women, but also like is within communication within rad femme spaces, do you see any progress? Do you see any room for, you know, improvement in our communication between our communities? Or is this just one of those things that's just going to play out however it plays out?
I'm not hopeful. As I was sitting here, I was thinking, and this, I think I've told you about this, at the University of Arizona, I believe, a group of women wanted to have an art show celebrating the vulva.
Yeah.
Like Georgia O'Keeffe, you know, whatever. Anyhow, a group of trans women disrupted the event and went to the university and said this is discriminatory.
Mm-hmm. There was the issue. I mean, there was in Vancouver, there was the Vancouver Women's Library, which, you know, I support the women who did that because the thing
Who did what?
I support the women who disrupted it. I do, because they were, you know, there was trans exclusive radical feminists that were included within the library, a sex worker exclusive radical feminist that were included within the library, and trans women's voices were not uplifted and seen as like part of the movement. But, you know, at the same time, okay, yeah, I know. I hear you. Go ahead. I want to give you a voice too. We really have to.
I mean, have enough time.
We hardly do.
I disagree with you. Yeah. I think that this group of women got together to start a library of books they chose. I don't know enough to say. I mean, not everything has to include everybody.
Thank you. Yes.
But if it's a women's library, then it does need to.
I guess one point I would like to make is that what is so common in hateful rhetoric against immigrants in society right now, against Muslims in society right now, many of whom are women, many of whom are trans women, queer women, sex workers, is that individual events does not justify violence against a whole group. So taking a single event, which I think is kind of misinterpreted, but that event with that art show does not justify hateful or exclusionary rhetoric against an entire diverse group of women.
I totally hear everybody here. There's a lot of room for us to continue this conversation. We'll have to continue it out in the community. I just want to thank everyone who is here today because we're just about out of time. Does anybody have any last words they'd like to share?
Still love you dearly, Andra.
Yeah.
I love you all. And I think that listening to each other and then also critically thinking about whether our messages are helping more people have access to education, jobs, and healthcare, or whether our words and actions are limiting other women and using power over instead of power with. I think the more we use power with against, as was mentioned, forces of misogyny and patriarchy, the more we work with, the better we'll all be.
I totally agree with that. Andrea, where can people find your work or find you?
Yeah, I guess if you type in Andrea Queer Studies Oregon State, I will pop up in your Google results, and that's a little easier than me giving out an email address over the phone. So Andrea Queer Studies Oregon State.
Great. So if you want to find us at Transpositive, we're at transpositive.wordpress.com. And we're also on here on KBOO on the first Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. Thank you so much for joining us. Carol, thank you very much. I really appreciate
you for
having the courage to come in. And Andrea, I really appreciate you having the courage to come in. And Jean, thank you for being here.
Yay.
Thank you,
everyone. Happy Women's Day.
Happy Women's Day.
Happy International Women's Day. Yes.
You come and go, you come and go. Loving would be the evening colors of light, my dream. Red, gold, and green. Red, gold, and green.
That was an excerpt of Transpositive from 2017 titled, What is Transfeminism? Looking at the intersections between gender identity and feminism, and how women across the spectrum can support one another. This has been KBOO's 2022 International Women's Month series, on every Friday in March from 6 to 7 p.m., as a part of our All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. To show your support for locally produced programming like this, you can go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution. You can listen back to all the fun programming from this campaign at kboo.fm/thrills. Thanks for tuning in and celebrating Women's History Month with us. For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala, bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Jha. I go by